Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Ben Carrington, a professor in the Annenberg School of Communication and Journalism at the University of Southern California, where he teaches sociology. He previously taught at the University of Brighton in England and the University of Texas at Austin, and currently serves on the editorial boards of Identities, Global Studies in Culture and Power, the Journal of Sport and Social Issues, and the International Review for the Sociology of Sport. His latest book is Race, Sport, and Politics. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ben Carrington.
Hi, nice to join you.
Well, thank you, Ben. And race, sports, and politics could not be more apparent at this moment. President Trump was asked after his incendiary comments down at the Von Braun Center in Huntsville, Alabama, that has created a firestorm. And yesterday, Sunday, across the television, there was a manifestation of solidarity and indignation expressed by NFL players and owners alike. But the only comment we've heard from the president was asked by a reporter about the racial component to his statements, and he said this has nothing to do with racism. That's pretty hard to take, isn't it, given that most of the NFL players and NBA players are black, and the vast majority of the owners of both the NFL and the NBA are white?
Yeah, I mean, it's classic Trump, in as much as that he uses racially coded language, which sometimes is barely coded at all, and so that he can speak race without explicitly mentioning race. So you're absolutely right. The NBA is about 80, maybe 85% black. The NFL was about 65% black. And at least in the kind of popular imagination, especially with the NBA, like, these are known as predominantly black sports. And the athletes that he referred to, those sons of bitches, as he referred to them, nearly all of them, not exclusively, nearly all of the players that have been protesting have been African American. So that was clearly known to the audience. And so when Trump refers to our heritage in that speech, he's clearly talking about a white notion of American history and heritage. And when he refers to those sons of bitches, he's referring almost exclusively to black players. And then again, also, like, when he supposedly withdrew the invite to Steph Curry and the Warriors to visit the White House after their championship win last year, that's a predominantly black team. And so again, Trump is clever in his rhetoric, in as far as he can signal to his audience that he is invoking a white nationalist politics without ever explicitly saying so. And that allows him that kind of defense. And you saw it today from the press secretary at the White House. This notion that this had nothing to do with race, we didn't mention race. The only people who are injecting race into the conversation are the anti-racists, the activists, Black Lives Matter kind of activists, etc.
Well, when Trump tweeted out that if a player wants the privilege of making millions of dollars in the NFL or other leagues, he or she should not be allowed to disrespect our great American flag or country and should stand for the national anthem. If not, you're fired. Find something else to do. Bringing in the idea of privilege of making money, millions, again, predominantly black athletes, that has a whiff, doesn't it, of dog whistle, the idea that somehow you should be grateful and shut the hell up?
Absolutely. I mean, it's a version of saying these are uppity athletes who are getting above their station. They need to be put back into their place. And their place is to sing and to dance and to entertain and to run and to catch. The other part of, that has a long racist history of allowing black people, black bodies, a certain space within mainstream culture, as long as it's at the kind of behest and for the entertainment of white folks and white eyes. And the moment that those black entertainers or sports figures begin to make demands, they're very quickly shut down and explicitly said, no, shut up and play. This is interesting as well. Like, we pay you. And the notion here, I guess, is that Trump is aligning himself with the owners and all the fans, which is interesting as well. I mean, if you go to any NFL game or NBA game, and I go to quite a few NBA games, I'm just struck by the difference, the kind of disjuncture between the predominantly white fan base of many of these teams and the overwhelmingly black sporting labour that you see on the court. And so when Trump says, you know, like, we're paying you, that we, I would argue, is a sense of kind of white people here. Even, you know, either because I'm a fan who buys a jersey, or I'm a fan who is into fantasy football, I'm a fan who goes to games, or because I'm one of the owners, there's a sense that we own your body, and we can tell you what to do with it, you know, and therefore any demands that you make outside the sporting field become illegitimate. And then the hour, like, I mean, that quote you just read is really important, this kind of contrast between us and them. And the us is always inflected as the notion of this is white society, and this notion that we've given you a chance. I mean, they have a part of it is this suggestion that you're lucky to have this chance. You should be grateful. And this goes way back, this discourse. I mean, you can trace it back, I think, to the early 20th century in Jack Johnson, the first black heavyweight boxing champion. And he was the one, so Jack Johnson was born in Galveston, Texas. And at the time in the early 20th century, black boxers weren't allowed to compete for the heavyweight championship of the world on the basis that white athletes were so obviously superior to black athletes that, you know, it would have been an insult to even allow a black boxer into the ring alongside a white boxer, especially for the heavyweight championship, which was supposed to be the kind of pinnacle of manhood. And Jack Johnson becomes the first world heavyweight champion, and in 1908. And when he does, there's this kind of cry that goes out for what's called the Great White Hope. And when we still use this term sometimes in kind of popular discourse, but many people don't know the origins of the term. So the Great White Hope was this notion that somewhere out there could be a white man strong enough to put Jack Johnson back in his place and to restore the racial order. Because, you know, it's hard to argue that whites are superior to blacks to kind of the ideology that underpins Jim Crow racism if, you know, a Negro from Galveston, Texas, as the New York Times referred to Johnson as, you know, is beating up all these white guys in the ring in public. And so this kind of anxiety, I think, about black sporting achievement and black athletic success has a long history in the U.S. And that's and after Jack Johnson is finally defeated in 1915, the so-called color line is drawn. So it's literally black boxers can no longer compete for the heavyweight championship. And it's not until Joe Louis in the 1930s that you see another black champion emerge. But the key thing is that the criticism and the worry about Jack Johnson was that he didn't respect boundaries. You know, he kind of flaunted his wealth. He was outspoken. And from then on, you've had this kind of model that if black men are going to be allowed into our sports, you have to do so under the following conditions. You have to kind of be subservient. You can't speak out. You have to respect the rules. You, in a sense, you have to kind of disavow any sense of blackness, any sense of kind of radical politics, any sense of critical consciousness. And under those conditions, we'll accept you. And the moment that you err slightly, you're going to be subject to sanctions. Sometimes, you know, financial, but banning you from the sport, or a kind of a pushback, which in a sense threatens your career. And so you've always had this kind of good black athlete, bad black athlete kind of discourse, or dichotomy rather, that it's been really hard for black athletes to kind of tread. And I think in many ways Muhammad Ali in the 1960s and other athletes kind of challenged that model, that to be a successful black athlete, you have to be subservient, you have to be quiet. And in I think this recent wave of critical consciousness of athletes, and particularly black athletes, from you know, going back to 2012 when the Miami Heat famously wore the hoodies to show solidarity for the family of Trayvon Martin when Trayvon Martin was killed, through to players like LeBron James wearing I Can't Breathe t-shirts, and other WNBA players also wearing Black Lives Matter t-shirts before games. You've had this kind of wave, which I think Colin Kaepernick, there's kind of crystallized around Colin Kaepernick's protest, but that's kind of fundamentally challenged this notion that black athletes should and must be quiet in order to play the game. And then finally, after many years, it seems like black athletes are finding their voice. And then the pushback, the kind of the backlash articulated through Trump is quite phenomenal. So I think we're actually in very interesting, but actually in kind of very dangerous times, especially given the central place of sports to American culture, especially kind of American male culture. The kind of it's the spectacle of sport, and especially the spectacle of football, is so powerful in generating strong emotions of attachment and identity that if you know in the midst of this, you kind of insert the explicit kind of race question. I think we're in very kind of combustible times.
And again, I'm speaking with Ben Carrington, a professor in the Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism at the University of Southern California, where he teaches sociology. And of course, in addition to Trump's remarks about calling Colin Kaepernick a son of a bitch and his tweets against Steph Curry, he also said that, in effect, these black athletes were showing total disrespect of our heritage, a total disrespect of everything that we stand for, adding for emphasis, everything that we stand for. So that was a really loud dog whistle, Ben. But in general, my sense is, I was watching television yesterday, which is a ritual, I think, for lots of people, lots of couch potatoes drinking beer. A lot of them are white, as you point out, and almost all the players are black. This could end up backfiring on Trump. The fact that the NFL owners, and again, of the 32 NFL teams, there are zero black owners. And in the NBA, Michael Jordan is the only black owner of a team. So what's your sense of that, the solidarity that was expressed by both the NFL players and the white owners?
Yeah, it's really interesting to see. And it's, so in normal circumstances, what Trump said at the weekend, especially when he personalized it in the language that he used, would normally have been a step too far, and there would have been a kind of backlash against Trump, and you know, and people who otherwise may have defended him or come to his side or supported him would have faded away. But there's been so many examples for the past 2 years when people have said, okay, this is it, this is the moment, and I like you. You attack John McCain's record as a war hero, or you attack the Pope, you know, or you admit on tape to sexual assault. I mean, we could just go on and on of the times in which there's been this kind of narrative that, okay, he's gone too far, and this notion of kind of middle America, this kind of the conservative person who maybe voted for Trump but wasn't fully ideologically behind him. Now, the argument that these aren't the Steve Bannons, the kind of Breitbart readers for whom Trump is their guy, the kind of the good but perhaps misguided middle America who will finally be kind of pushed. That hasn't happened, like, time and time again. So there appears to be a way in which people will square the circle and say, clearly you shouldn't be talking about sexually assaulting women, but hey, that's just locker room talk. Or, you know, that's just Trump. That's just Trump being Trump, and I kind of like the fact that he says it. And I think maybe the truth is, and maybe this is a bit scary for some of us to admit, that actually, at least in private, and there is a difference between the private and the public, I agree, but at least in private, I would guess that many people have referred to those protesting athletes as sons of bitches. And I wouldn't surprise me if many of the owners think the same thing or said the same thing. So in a sense, so Trump articulates what the, I mean, just as an example, I mean, you talked to, I've watched the speech in Alabama a few times. The reaction of the crowd isn't one of horror. Yes, the crowd don't boo, or there's no gasp of, in terms of, like, what has Trump just said. Like, if you remember, like, there's a part of it in the middle where the crowd starts chanting USA, USA, USA. This kind of, you know, especially coming from Europe, now, these fascistic moments when there's a mobilization of very powerful identities around nationalism and race in a sporting setting. And so actually, although it's true that some of the owners, and indeed some of the owners who've actually donated to Trump over the years, came out and showed solidarity with their players and locked arms, I'm not so sure. I think it would be a mistake to read those moments as kind of an anti-Trump moment. There's certainly, like, the NFL is a business. Let's not forget this, yes? Like, the NFL is a business. And Trump effectively, although he walked it back a little bit today, was effectively calling for a boycott of a business over the weekend. So if that's your business, you're not going to come out and say, like, yes, you should boycott my business. I would like to go out of business. So, I mean, let's be quite clear here. There's a financial logic and a financial imperative of the NFL owners kind of collectively to kind of push back at least, or at least to show kind of solidarity. And it's also the case, I mean, and there are different dynamics between the NBA and the NFL. I mean, maybe we could talk about that. But historically, at least, the NFL players, an NFL player doesn't have the same power as the NBA players. But what Trump managed to do spectacularly was to kind of unifying to produce solidarity amongst NFL players, which normally isn't there. They don't have the same guaranteed contracts. The squads are much bigger. I mean, it's easier to mobilize 15 to 16 to 17 to 18 NBA players on a squad than it is to mobilize 60, 65, 70 football players on a squad. The units are much tighter in the NBA. There's a much higher percentage of African Americans, and a few players on the NBA and on the NBA team have enormous power within the organization. That's not quite the same in the NFL. And interestingly, actually, the players that tend to have the most power in the NFL locker rooms are often quarterbacks, often white quarterbacks, and many of them quite conservative quarterbacks. So spectacularly, Trump has managed to unify quite a kind of politically disparate and racially more diverse NFL locker room alongside the owners, but I think for very different reasons. It will be interesting to see what happens in the coming days and weeks as the season develops. But yes, there is a degree of solidarity, but I think it isn't so much an anti-Trump kind of moment. And especially then, you get this kind of confusing moment where, you know, what does it mean to kind of lock arms? You know, the Kaepernick kind of protest was to kneel. There's still kind of an embrace of the flag and nationalism in those moments of unity amongst some of these teams and their owners. But I also do think, like, the honest answer is we don't know where this is going to go. I mean, that, if we've learned anything from Trump and the ways in which we would normally read politics, is that we simply don't know. That makes it kind of exciting and interesting, but it also makes it hugely unnerving. And I can imagine now the NFL owners are really worried about where this might go next. Because a sport which for so long was one of the most conservative sports, yes, it was a sport which, despite its rhetoric, the owners wield a lot of power. The players can lose their jobs, you know, relatively easily, and it's never allowed the type of kind of political articulations that you see in other sports. That's all changed now, so we really are in uncharted territory.
Well, we've run out of time, but it's a bit of an irony that the speech down in Huntsville, Alabama, was in the Von Braun Center, named after Werner Von Braun, whose V-2 rockets rained down on England during World War II, something I'm sure you're quite aware of, Ben. And it does seem extraordinary that in the broad context that Donald Trump has insulted so many people, but the only people he hasn't insulted, in fact, he's praised, are neo-Nazis and Vladimir Putin. So go figure.
They're very fine people, as he would call them, yes.
Well, I thank you for joining us. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Ben Carrington, who's a professor in the Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism at the University of Southern California, where he teaches sociology. He previously taught at the University of Brighton in England and the University of Texas at Austin, and currently serves on the editorial boards of Identities, Global Studies in Culture and Power, the Journal of Sports and Social Issues, and the International Review for the Sociology of Sport. And his latest book is Race, Sport, and Politics. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.